From KQED Public Radio, this is the Capital Notes podcast for February. Why don't I look at the calendar before I come in? February 18th?
Sure.
February 19th?
Whichever.
19th
it could be
a
both.
Friday. And you're hearing this on Friday.
Therefore, it's the 19th.
Right.
Geometry podcast.
I need a calendar in the studio. I'm John Myers from KQED Public Radio. The calendar man is Anthony York.
There is no calendar.
Oh, right. Yeah, but you kept me straight. The editor of Capital Weekly and blog king for the Los Angeles Times.
Blocking.
I don't know what to call you. I've been calling you blogger extraordinaire, but blog king for this week.
Okay.
Since there's a royalty theme that we'll talk about later.
Ah, is that a Gavin Newsom joke?
Podcast. Well, no. There's more than one royalty in politics, apparently.
You're talking about Prince Frederick's run for governor?
There's even another one.
Yes, okay.
See, it was a royal week in politics.
Right.
It's a royal pain. Where we last left off, our drama from last week's podcast, you got to love a podcast that is dated before it actually ever hits the internets.
It's, you know, blame the, media conspiracy.
Or I guess it just kind of goes to show, too, that we were in the middle of a situation that was so unusual that we had no idea the governor was going to change course.
It got unusualer.
Nice. Yeah. You write for a living.
Yes.
So we're talking about the Abel Maldonado saga, the governor's choice for a lieutenant governor. When we last left off, dun-dun-dun, last Thursday, we need like some soap opera saga music.
Like sands in the hourglass.
Yeah, really. So. When we last left off, the assembly leadership thought they had rejected the Maldonado confirmation. The governor said you had not rejected it and said we will be happy to take you to court. We ended the podcast that way, not knowing that just mere hours later, the governor would abandon the going to court path, withdraw the nomination, and resubmit the nomination, thereby starting a new 90-day clock that the legislature has to either accept or confirm Mr. Maldonado, the Republican from the Central Coast.
So, Exciting.
Yeah. So, I mean, change in strategy. Uh-huh. But beyond that, second verse, same as the first.
Yeah. Has the lieutenant governor's job gotten any more important since last we spoke?
Let me check. No.
Okay. Just because here we are talking about it 2 weeks in a row. And look, it's good drama, but what it means for the people of California, eh.
Yeah, but this is a politics podcast.
Okay, you don't
have to do that whole disclaimer
drama
about it's not really important to people's lives. Because let's face it, we don't really talk about – no, yes, we do in some ways. But we like to talk just regular old politics sometimes.
Okay.
Politically, it's quite the interesting little conundrum.
Is it not? It is. And, you know, we'll see what Democrats in the assembly end up doing. This now moves the calendar to sometime until late May, right?
May 17th, I think.
When the Democrats have to act. So, you know, will they take Maldonado up before then? Maybe. Do they let him twist in the wind for a couple of months more? And what does it mean for the state budget? I mean, there are some interesting machinations here.
Well, but one of the things that's been interesting over the last week since this all played out in its craziness last Thursday, what I think has been interesting too is how the reaction out in the public, the piles and piles of editorials and opinion writers criticizing the assembly and the assembly Democrats are in particular,
right,
for partisan politics and playing games and all the other nasty things that were said. Some of this discussion about that we kind of alluded to last week, and you guys at Capital Weekly took it a step further this week in doing actually a piece on it, some of the way it's played out in the Latino community in some parts of California,
right,
or at least the way that Republicans hope it will play out in the Latino
community.
Yeah. And a very difficult place for Assembly Democrats to be right now, because they've got to figure out what the next step is. The ball is in their court. You're right. They could wait a while, let it blow over, maybe do something else. But the governor has every reason to keep pushing it, and his team has a reason to keep pushing the question.
Sure.
And
don't have to talk about the budget, right?
Yeah, and I've heard from different people around in the Capitol that there is a little bit of hand-wringing going on by some Democrats in the Assembly, that they have found themselves in the middle of a storm, that they're not really they've taken some of this criticism to heart over what's happened over the last week.
And remember, this is sort of the first political test for the new speaker. Speaker-elect John Perez is pretty much in control of his caucus now that the current speaker, Karen Bass, is officially running for Congress.
That happened this week, too.
But, you know, Perez takes over March 1st. But, you know, for all intents and purposes, he has been the de facto speaker, certainly sort of leading the charge on this Maldonado play. And it does put Assembly Democrats in a tough spot. Look, not many of them are worried about reelection. They're in safe districts. And, you know, if there's a tidal wave here, the Assembly Democrats would lose four seats. But it is this sort of, you know, it feeds into a pervasive cynicism about Sacramento, about how the legislature does its business. And it is a political problem, and perhaps not directly in terms of the immediate political futures for members of the legislature, but for the institution as a whole, I don't think that this does them any good.
I was going to say, too, I mean, and I think that's I think you're right. You're spot on about you know, that it puts the new speaker in an interesting position about how much power he has. And, you know, there have been disparate opinions as to whether this showed that he didn't have enough power or this was him exerting his power by making sure Maldonado didn't technically get the confirmation. But
right.
But aside from that, too, I mean, the other issue here, too, and I mean, maybe this was a miscalculation, I don't know, but Abel Maldonado has gotten a hell of a lot more attention than he would have gotten if it had been a quick confirmation vote.
Right.
And that was the calculation in the upper house, in the Senate. They weren't terribly thrilled about it, the Democrats in that caucus, but I think they kind of all decided, we're going to let it go, we're going to give him the job now, we're going to go back to the budget and go take the fight back to the issues that we need to take it to. Now, Maldonado has gotten tons of free press. Regardless of what happens to whether he gets the job for 10 months, he's gotten a ton. You can't buy that. He didn't have that kind of money.
He doesn't.
To get that kind of press.
No, he doesn't. His campaign reports show that.
And so that may have been a miscalculation on their part.
Well, and that was in that sense, it did have the same effect as a rejection, sort of the Maldonado as martyr concern that a lot of Democrats had.
But it didn't come with the benefit of the rejection because he still has a chance.
Well,
at
he
the
gets
job.
To play this out
yeah,
for
he gets
two
to play
or three
it out
months.
even further. And yes. Daryl Steinberg, the leader of the state Senate, said this week, made it clear. I think it would have been obvious anyway, but he pretty much made it clear when he was asked about it in an event. He's not going to act first. It's
nope.
The assembly. This is the assembly's problem to resolve first. The Senate
right.
already had a vote to confirm Maldonado. He doesn't see a need to do anything. And I think that's probably. That's probably the easy bet for him too. Avoid why stick back in that thing?
Well, and who knows? You know, I mean, the potential for irony here is immense, right? That Maldonado's political future could get wrapped into a future budget vote. I mean, could this be some of the quid pro quo that we always see, which is arguably how Maldonado ended up in this position in the first place? I mean, we'll see. I don't know. You know, I think it is an interesting test for Perez. I think it's sort of the most interesting thing for me in terms of covering this place day to day. You know, was this a sign of strength that, you know, as you suggested, potentially that he'd stop Maldonado from being confirmed, or the fact that he couldn't get 41 votes, couldn't get 41 members of his caucus to vote no? Is that a sign of weakness? And what sort of lasting impacts does this have on Perez's leadership within his caucus? Remember, I mean, Perez, and it's still unclear to me whether Perez was reacting to the will of the majority of his caucus, or whether this was his own agenda that he wanted. I mean, there was even some speculation that he deliberately wanted to keep it above 41 or below 41, but wanted to make sure that he wanted Maldonado to be in this sort of no man's land.
Maldo limbo.
Yeah, but, you know, who knows?
What about the influence of interest groups?
Well, I don't know how hard they were pushing necessarily. I mean, look, Maldonado's been endorsed by the California Teachers Association. I had heard early on that labor wasn't going to engage heavily on the Maldonado thing, and I don't know if they did. I just don't. I don't have that level of detail. I mean, maybe you know something I don't. But
you're the inside man.
No.
I was going to you for the inside play.
I don't know.
Well, the bottom line is, as we started, the clock starts again. It's a 90-day clock, and you know, so here we have it hanging over a lot of issues. We have it hanging over budget votes. We had a series of budget votes in the Senate here on Thursday.
Right.
That the budget work we'll talk about more next week concludes on Monday next week in both houses, we're told. So that's a reason for us to talk about budget next week.
Well,
but if you look at I was just going to say quickly, if you look at Maldonado's votes on the package of budget bills so far today, he was yes on some, no on others.
Yep.
You know, kind of where he
you is.
Know, and those were probably very carefully constructed votes that he took on
I'm
those.
Sure. So. I mean, you know, one interesting thing about resetting the clock is this now, if I believe April 21st is sort of the magic day. If they drag this out beyond April 21st, it gives the governor the ability to consolidate the runoff election with the November 2010 election. That would theoretically be a higher turnout election and increase Democrats' chances of picking up that Senate seat. Was that part of the calculation here? Was this sort of some play orchestrated between the speaker and the governor? Who knows? But it is interesting, at least, that this could actually have some political benefits for Democrats if indeed you know, this does drag on for a couple more months.
Yeah, and at least technically, it's going to drag on for a bit longer. So yeah, we spent a lot of time talking about a job that is lampooned a lot before this.
Well, and it's not just Maldonado.
And it is not. See, you knew where I was going.
Oh, I did.
I must have told you how I wanted to move forward here.
I just follow your orders blindly, don't I?
Yes, good soldier that you are. Yeah, chatter this week about another late entry into the lieutenant governor's race. One that, by the way, I said I had a feeling that he could jump in this race when he got out of the race for governor. Gavin Newsom, the mayor of San Francisco.
Yep, and I think his political consultant once upon a time said if Gavin Newsom ever got into the lieutenant governor's race, he would check to see if he had been abducted by one-eyed aliens from Pluto.
That political consultant, Gary South, who now works for the other person running for lieutenant governor in the Democratic side, Janice Hahn.
Well, one of the others. Also
one of the others.
Dean Flores.
Right. Sorry, Senator Flores. Apologies.
Yes.
So Newsom, toying with the idea of getting in the race, submitted a formal candidate statement because he had to, but then files a statement that looks like he's in the race if you read it.
Right.
But then through a spokesman says, well, he's not making a real decision until March 12th, the deadline, because he's still weighing the odds.
Because there's more free media to be had.
There, yeah. What do you make of this? Late entry, guy with no cash raised at all.
It doesn't paint the best picture of Gavin Newsom, I must say. I mean, here's a guy who's lost some standing in the polls in San Francisco because he was off running for governor for a year. And now you've got a weird situation in San Francisco where a lot of progressives in San Francisco who have sort of been Newsom detractors might want him to run because they would get to select his successor under San Francisco city, county charter. Whatever it is, it's a city and a county.
Only in San Francisco.
And a dessert topping. Look, Gavin Newsom has always positioned himself as a person of substance. I think if you asked him about lieutenant governor rumors while he was a candidate for governor, he was openly dismissive of the job and the possibility that he would ever deign to run for that job. And now, you know, when asked why he would consider it, he wants to make it a bully pulpit for cities and counties. I mean,
you're referring to the candidate statement that he filed, right? Exactly.
Right. And it just seems like okay.
And
okay.
Then this comes after some well publicized interview comments where New York Times most prominently with Maureen Dowd, their columnist, where he said something like, "I'm done with politics."
Right.
I mean, and so he opens himself up to a real, what do you want? You know, how does anybody know really what, you know, all of that kind of stuff that, again, detracts from whatever his campaign message would be in a campaign that I think, you know, is not one to sneeze at, as you accurately pointed out to me early when I was the Newsom could run for lieutenant governor theory guy. And you accurately, I think, talked about, you know, Janice Hahn, again, apologies, Senator Flores, but I'm just looking down south. Janice Hahn is not exactly a pushover in that race.
And Newsom has some other troubles as well. Number one, he's already gone to a lot of his donors who have maxed out to him during his run for governor. So and under Proposition 34, the state's campaign finance law, he can't go back to those people to ask them to donate for a new office. Like he's maxed out $6,500. Anybody who's given him $6,500 or more for his run for governor can't give him another dime for lieutenant governor.
In which case,
governor.
He'd have to ask a whole. He'd have to find another right. whole set of donors.
And you know, I think some of the insider angle. I mean, the thing I'd like to see is, you know, I'm sure Gary South, who's now Janice Hahn's political consultant, used to work for Gavin Newsom. I'm sure Gary South. Acquired quite a dossier on Newsom when he worked for him, and it would be interesting to see how and if and how that that sort of inside information is used if indeed Hahn is running against Newsom for lieutenant governor.
You're saying he knows things.
I'm thinking he might.
If you're right, exactly. You don't want to run a race probably against a guy you hired to make sure. He knew everything so he could be prepared for it.
Right. It's like, you know, a defensive coordinator of a football team goes and becomes a head coach somewhere else and they play. Well, anyway.
Yeah.
Moving on.
I got it. I'm
moving
with the football
on.
Analogy
okay.
there.
All right,
well,
good.
It's interesting that you brought up Prop 34 because that's a good nice Segway. Transition into another topic. I don't know if you did that intentionally, but.
It's also effortless.
You're getting good at this radio thing, York. And Prop 34, for those who need a quick refresher, was a proposal that was, you know, somewhat, you know, craftily put on the ballot by the legislature back in 2000 to avoid a campaign finance system that they didn't want. So they kind of got the voters to pass this one. Yes, it has these limits on races for elective office, but it has absolutely no limits, no holds barred. If you are an independent campaign, an independent expenditure campaign, you can spend whatever you want. In favor or against a candidate as long as you are not technically coordinating with that candidate and that campaign.
Correct.
And so and you know, we mentioned this when the Supreme Court ruling happened a few weeks ago, that the Supreme Court ruling on the national level will create a system like we've been living in California with these IEs. Spend whatever you want as long as you're not part of the campaign or the candidate's campaign.
Give directly. Right.
Well, and so now we're gonna get an interesting dose of this. It appears not one, not two, but three.
So far, yes.
So far, promised. Independent expenditure campaigns promised to beat up the potential Republican nominee for governor, Meg Whitman.
Yes.
Although at least one of them said, we would also beat up Steve Poizner if he happens to win the nomination.
Right.
We're not going to just beat up Whitman.
We're going to beat up whatever Republican frontrunner.
And these aren't efforts to say great things about Jerry Brown.
Not yet.
And I think too, because they would like to maintain that appearance of distance. But they are Democrats who, to paraphrase the name of one of them, argue that they need to level the playing field.
Right.
When Whitman or Poizner, multi-millionaires or billionaires, spend their own money in this race, and Jerry Brown is not famously wealthy. And so these folks come in and do the heavy hitting for him.
Well, right, heavy hitting, you know. We'll see how big the bat is. I mean, they've come in with promises of spending $20, $30, $40 million so far.
First of all, and they're three efforts. I was just going to say that. I don't mean to interrupt you. There are three efforts. Two of them are statewide entities, basically. The third one is supposedly going to be sponsored by the Democratic Governors Association, which would be more of a national operation, at least maybe in financing.
Right. And we've seen one of the statewide efforts, this Level the Playing Field group, show its hand this week and launch two new radio spots. And then the Democratic Governors Association PAC, launches a website and has, you know, and somebody with a Democratic strategist with an email list is, you know, it seems to be up and running here. So, but you know, a lot of this is, we'll have to wait and see how, I mean, I think that
there
will be
major.
Well,
let's just put it out there. You and I talked about this before. There's no money so far. We haven't seen the money. There's no records of money at the, you know, at the state finance records.
Although they made a radio ad buy, apparently. They bought about $50,000 worth of radio. Yeah. People have analyzed the buy. Why that money hasn't shown up at the Secretary of State's office yet, I don't know.
We'll find out.
Yeah.
But what they got out of the gate was a hell of a lot of free media.
Yeah.
They got a great big attention. Rightly or wrongly, we're not going to be media critics here, but rightly or wrongly, from some news organizations around the state, got an awful lot of attention about going after Whitman, and I think going after Whitman in ways that are not surprising. That's not to say they won't work, but they're not surprising. They're going after her money, and they're going after her record as CEO of eBay. Again, whether they work or not remains to be seen.
Right.
But I don't think I'm surprised that that's what they would go after.
Right, and you know, people have been making the comparisons to what Gray Davis did in the 2002 race for governor, running ads in a Republican primary, sort of going after Richard Reardon, the perceived front runner at the time, to try to knock down Reardon's candidacy, and Reardon ended up losing that nomination fight, and Gray Davis got the candidate he wanted, Bill Simon, and beat him. The difference there, of course, is that Gray Davis spent $9 million in a month hammering Richard Reardon on television, and this now is just, you know, we see a $50,000 ad buy on conservative radio stations or conservative talk shows. It's not, you know, as one consultant I talked to this week told me, they said, look, you're not going to kill Meg Whitman on radio. And I think that this is just sort of a way of these groups sort of putting themselves out there. It's almost hat in hand, saying, hey, look, we're the first guys who are willing to step up to Meg Whitman and give her, you know, the proverbial, you know, throw the first proverbial punch here. And so give us money, you know, allow us to take them on. There's a lot more to this right now. There are some reasons why the unions, I don't think, want to show their hands just yet.
Why is that?
There are a couple initiatives out there. Number one would be a reform on pensions, and number two, the so-called Paycheck Protection Initiative that would limit unions' ability to raise money from their members for political campaigns. And there's a real fear from some unions that if they show their hand too soon and drop millions of dollars against Meg Whitman, that Whitman could write a check to finance one or both of these efforts on the ballot. They would have to spend tens of millions of dollars to try to beat them back. So we saw some sort of pushback internally from some unions against this independent expenditure group. I think that the union money will come in on Jerry Brown's behalf. Whether it's through these IEs or other groups, people doing their own thing, the money will come. I just think it's going to be later. It's going to be after that window closes so that Whitman can't sort of light the fire under these initiatives and qualify them for the ballot.
Well, I think you've even called it before, lighting all the fires at once.
Yeah.
You know, this notion that Meg Whitman has so much personal money that it would be no big deal for her to finance a number of them in order to diffuse the money from her opposition and therefore make her – right. So this is a lot of strategy going on.
Right.
It seems like a – yeah.
But it also shows the lack of control that you have. I mean, you know, the various groups are playing chess, right? They're playing this chess with these initiatives. Then you have somewhat – you know, these other groups sort of running out there, getting started and – potentially imperiling what other strategists see as the bigger play. It shows the lack of control you have when independent expenditures come into the mix and start sort of competing with each other for attention and space and sort of political bandwidth.
Well, and I want to take a moment and talk a little bit about at least the message, the independent expenditure anti-Whitman message that was peddled this week, most particularly yeah. by the Level the Playing Field group, which made it in no uncertain terms that they believe anger is so ripe with corporate America that they want to link Meg Whitman, the former corporate boss, to that anger with corporate America. Now, you know, I see the strategy. I see
yeah.
why they think that might work. I have a hard time seeing eBay linked to J.P. Morgan,
right.
Bank of America, and Bear Stearns,
right.
and Goldman Sachs.
It's old Wall Street. It's you know, it's Dow Jones Wall Street. It's not NASDAQ Wall
yeah.
Street where this anger is.
And they made a few other accusations about California jobs that were eliminated in eBay, and so she could pad her own bank account. They wanted her taxes. Those are things we hear in a lot of political campaigns.
Right. Right.
The other thing but there was a word that stuck out to me. The strategist behind all of this briefed reporters in Sacramento and in San Francisco on Wednesday. There was a word that stuck out to me in the Sacramento briefing, which was that Meg Whitman's money is tainted, that it is tainted by all of these evil wrongdoings. And that goes beyond just the class warfare, which is easy. She's rich. You're not, California voter.
Right.
You know, and that starts to, like, you know, go down a path that I personally think you've got to have some way to prove at some point. Again,
yeah.
this is very early. These are just, you know, things designed to get quotes and sound bites, and I appreciate that. But, you know, calling her money tainted, I mean, you know, where I would like to know what that is. And we'll see whether this lasts. I mean, who knows?
I will say the sort of the first steps out of the gate here, both from this group and from the Democratic Governors Association group, they seemed a little shrill. And I think also, if you look at it, I mean, the Whitman campaign kind of celebrated these ads. I mean, it allowed them to say, hey, look, the big Democratic guns are coming for us. Now's the time to get Steve Poizner out of this race. And you saw a couple of instances this week where Whitman supporters
sent emails around
trying to get Poizner. Yeah. And it allowed Meg Whitman to begin the general election campaign, which is what she wants to do.
Right. She'd rather take on Brown than have to take on Poizner.
Sure, right. Sure. And so I think there's a way in which, ironically perhaps, this early on, that the Whitman campaign is sort of happy that these folks are out there doing what they're doing. I mean, that might be the wrong word, but the point's well taken.
Yeah. But let's quickly talk, because I want to get to our third subject. I want to quickly talk about the Whitman-Poizner dynamic and the status of that. I mean, there was a lot of discussion about debates this week. There seemed to be what I thought was a bit of an internal Republican Party kind of fracas that kind of, I don't know, at the end, I'm not sure it really worked out for the party very well, where people were pushing to have the candidates debate at the state Republican convention next month, and then all of a sudden the party brass said, no, we're not going to do it. We're backing off of it for whatever reason. Hmm. They won't do it. And then there was some grumbling.
Any theories? Any theories?
I don't want to play that. I mean, I don't have any intel. Maybe you do. And then there was grumbling about that. But I get back to a larger point, which is that, you know, I want to give respect to the Poizner campaign. But the Poizner campaign, the clock keeps ticking. The clock keeps ticking for something to come back at Whitman. The one offensive play in recent weeks has been the charges of
meanness,
extortion, or whatever he was trying to make the point.
Criminal meanie-dom.
She was, you know, threatening him, or Mike Murphy was. That's been the only offensive play now for a while, and days are clicking away, and maybe her support is just on name ID from radio ads. But at a certain point, how far can you go if you're Steve Poizner to get back in this race?
I do think, though, that the press is beginning to get engaged here. You saw Meg Whitman speaking.
Engaged?
Well, Meg Whitman spoke to the Commonwealth Club in Lafayette in Northern California this week, and was, I think, one report I saw said she was bum rushed after by reporters trying to
that's so dated. Nobody says bum rushed anymore.
Well, I'm just relaying what I heard.
Go ahead.
Anyway, now that my slang has been criticized, that Whitman hasn't held a press conference in a while, and so, again, looking for sort of narratives to be forming, the fact that she isn't debating Poizner, that she's not talking to reporters, does that begin to sort of say, you know, the Meg Whitman, what are you hiding kind of thing? Does that attack begin to resonate? I mean, ironically, you know, her whole radio pitch is talk to Meg, right? Well, reporters have tried to do just that and haven't had a whole lot of luck.
So, I just don't know that it works. I mean, I hope it works because I'm a reporter and I think she needs to answer serious questions. It didn't work with Arnold Schwarzenegger, though. I mean, I'll play it out for a moment.
Yeah.
It was a shorter campaign. I know it's not an apples-to-apples comparison, but there was a lot of avoiding substantive Q&As with the press. He only debated once. People said, oh, it really, what's he afraid of to debate and then mix it up and engage, yada-da, yada-da, yada-da. And it didn't stick with the public. Now, obviously, it's a different year. It's a different era. It's a different campaign. But I just don't know how much that's us versus the public.
A lot of it is. A lot of it is. But remember, Arnold Schwarzenegger, I mean, people already knew Arnold Schwarzenegger. People had a sense of who he was,
right? People buy and sell things on eBay. Not just going.
Yeah, but when I'm buying and selling things on eBay, I'm not thinking Meg Whitman. You know, I don't know who that is, you know? So Arnold Schwarzenegger had a reservoir of sort of public goodwill that Whitman doesn't have. Now, maybe these radio ads that she's been running for 4 months now, and maybe her new TV ads, maybe that's a way to try to build that without ever engaging. But I think at some point, I mean, remember Schwarzenegger, when he finally did debate, the cry had become so loud that when he showed that he had a sort of a general command of some issues, it sort of set everyone's mind at ease and I think helped him and ended up helping him. And could that happen with Whitman? Yeah, possibly. But, you know, the one press conference that I remember her holding was one involving her voting record, and she didn't handle that one real well. And so at some point, I think people are going to have to see her as a governor. You know, she has to sort of become gubernatorial, and I don't think that she's done that yet. And I think that it's going to put her at a disadvantage, you know, if and when she ends up going head-to-head with Jerry Brown.
But I will say, in one more parallel to the Arnold Schwarzenegger campaign, there was an instance of that as well. He announced for governor. The next day he was on the Today Show. He botched it. He was bad.
Right.
I mean, he couldn't answer the questions. He couldn't deal with Matt Lauer's interrogation of him. And then he went into hiding. Not hiding, but he went off the radar for a while he got polished and came back and right in the bar was set. So, I mean, in some ways, I mean, I don't know. It may all work out fine, and we'll see.
We'll see.
But it is a chance at a narrative. And, I mean, at this point, again, the Poizner campaign needs a narrative. They need something
right.
to hang their hat on, I would think.
And the Democrats need one, too. So you have this sort of strange alliance now, right, between Poizner and the Democrats. We'll see how long that lasts.
Collusion, no. And then quickly before we go, we mentioned this at the end last week because we said it was a long podcast, and I'm looking at the stopwatch, and we're already a long podcast again, but let's give it a shot.
All right.
We have to mention the apparent end to one of the big government reform efforts in 2010, and I want to mention it because I'm plugging that KQED is doing a new year-and-a-half-long project on covering the crisis in governance in California. I think we're calling it State of Disarray. So we're all in disarray. And that begins Monday on the California Report. So you can kqed.org or californiareport.org. There's my plug. But the folks back in a constitutional convention officially pulled the plug, or enough to have said they pulled the plug that we can all say they pulled the plug last week because they had no money. And they're having trouble raising money to get the two measures on the ballot. One, to give the voters the power to call a constitutional convention, and the second measure to actually convene a constitutional convention. And I'm just left. You tell me what you think of this, but I guess the one thing I'm left with is the people who have money in California politics all stood to lose by any major effort at reform. And I think that's the same problem with the other group. California Forward is having trouble raising money, and so you're going to ask money from people who don't want any of this stuff changed. And that I think poses a fundamental problem about going to the ballot, going the initiative route.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, look at, you know, if you're looking for irony here, look at, you know, the fact that Repair California and the efforts to bring the Constitutional Convention forward had to fold their campaign. And look what will be on the November ballot. Look at the groups that are going ahead with the November ballot who have the ability to put measures on. I mean, you've got business groups pushing a tax fee initiative. You've got the California Teachers Association pushing a repeal of corporate tax loopholes.
Even in the June ballot, you've got a big utility talking about the way utilities are created and public utilities.
And a big insurer talking about car insurance. So it sort of makes their point for them, I think, but also speaks to the difficulties of reforming the system. And people who think that the initiative system is sort of an outsider's way in, I think this kind of illustrates how the initiative system has been co-opted or become a tool of the very interests that do business and do battle on a daily basis inside the Capitol.
And the other thing that came out of that quickly, too, is that one of the biggest sponsors of the whole Constitutional Convention was the Bay Area Council, a group of business representatives in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim Wunderman, who is the leader of that group, in speaking to reporters in San Francisco last week when he announced that the campaign was over, effectively said that one of the problems they faced was that some donors didn't want to come forward until other donors came forward.
Right.
And some donors said, I'll give you money, but not until I can see that you've actually got money to run the campaign. And what I'm struck by with that is that even the people who are willing to reform the system have a bit of timidity about it. And they're looking for something to feel like that, something to hang their hat on. And so the question is, who steps up first? Who goes forward?
Well,
and who will open their checkbook enough?
And that's that mentality, you know, if you're going to shoot the bear, you got to kill the bear. You don't want to wound it. Because if they have many people...
Because a wounded bear is in trouble.
Yeah.
Isn't the bear the symbol of California?
Yeah, exactly. Well, the current state of California governance. If various interest groups, various powerful interests see this constitutional convention as a threat, and groups who are funding it. I mean, if they try and fail, you know, will there be retributions? And I think that, you know, a lot of folks are concerned about that. And I think a lot of businesses and a lot of the core groups at the Bay Area Council's own members. I mean, I think Chevron sort of balked at the idea of funding this constitutional convention. They could have if they wanted to. They certainly have the resources to do it, and they didn't. And so, I mean, again, it just sort of it ironically perhaps makes they're in their failure. They sort of are making their point, you know, about how entrenched some of these interests are.
Wounded bear.
Wounded bear.
That's what we should be calling our governance project.
There you go.
The wounded bear. Well, two wounded bears shuffling off. I didn't have an ending there. For Anthony York at Capital Weekly, I'm John Myers from KQED. We'll see you next time.